You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 64. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we talk about those archaeology skills you have and how they work in the real world.
Let's dig a little deeper. All right, welcome to the Archaeology Show. April, how the heck is it going over there?
Oh, man, it is going well. It's been really busy. Really, really busy, but good. It's been good.
Yeah.
I've been teaching an intro to anthropology course, and as part of that is a little bit of the inspiration for today's show, I guess, because I was lying in bed one night and thinking about all the things that I'm telling my students in class and all the stories and the random asides that you kind of use to keep class vaguely interesting, and realized all of the skills that we as anthropologists and archaeologists use that are really relevant to our everyday lives, but we would never actually think about. And that, you know, because it's a one-on-one class and I have very few majors, so I'm trying to sell them on all the ways that anthropology and archaeology are like the best thing ever to learn, even if you're not a major and you're probably not going to become a major because we don't really need more, you know, majors. It gets better to have a doctor who also understands other cultures. So, yeah. So I've been thinking about this all semester as I get through and slog through this semester. So,
well, that is good because I'm looking up right now on Amazon to see if I can find it. But there was a class, I took a senior seminar class. Oh, I think I found it. What a horrible book. I took a senior seminar class when I was in my undergrad. And one of the things, it's like they started us off with this by saying, okay, you've gone 4 years. For me, I did like 2 years because I was an aviation major first. But basically, you've gone 4 years. This is your last class in college. We're going to teach you how to get a job in anthropology, because it wasn't necessarily archaeology focused. I mean, it was an archaeology, an anthropology undergrad. And one of the books they had us read, one of the first ones we talked about, was called Careers in Anthropology by who I'm sure is a wonderful man, Richard Stevens Jr. And on Amazon right now, I'm looking, it's $23.80, and it's called Careers in Anthropology. And basically, none of the careers inside this book are actually in anthropology. Like, they're all in human resources and other stuff that you can use your anthropological skills. You're apparently, you studied people skills in college. That's what this guy assumed. And now you can work with other living human beings. Archaeology is not one of these because we only prefer dead people. But anthropology, it's
so
like,
what you're saying,
really?
Is
careers in anthropology?
Well, what I'm hearing from you too is that archaeology is for the anthropologist who failed on the interacting with living people side of the class.
Yes.
So they just shunt us over into isolated walking alone and dealing with dead people. I see your interpretation here.
I know. In one of my cultural anthropology classes, she had us write a poem about something. And I'm like, no, like, I don't want to do that. And then I think I was moved over to archaeology classes at that point. So, yeah, I don't write poems about my feelings. That's why I'm an archaeologist. Yeah. So anyway, careers in anthropology, you're right. But I think more specifically for me, This conversation today is going to be really more related to obviously archaeology, because that's what I've been doing the last 12, 13 years. And I think it's actually super relevant because I actually do a webinar. I'm not doing the live webinar anymore. I'm going to record this and put it up on our Team Black Patreon page. But it's called Getting Out is what I called it. And it's designed for two different types of people. One is people who want to transition out of archaeology and they think they have no skills. I've heard that so many times. They're like, man, I went through my undergrad, I went immediately into CRM archaeology, and I've been doing this for 4 or 5 years, and I just want to do something else. It's not for me. But now I'm unemployable because I have no skills. And I'm like, I have a whole hour-long webinar on, yes, you do have skills, and this is how this translates. This is how you translate it onto a resume as real-world job and abilities, no matter what position you're in. Even if you're a field tech your whole career, your short career, you can still translate that into a career in something else. And the other person that this is for, who I think would get something out of this as well, is somebody who's actually working in archaeology or anthropology. And like, for example, archaeology, and I don't know if it's the same for, you know, academics, maybe if you don't have a summer field school or summer field work to do. You could do something else. But these are for people who might just want a different job. Like for CRM, a lot of times you need 3 or 4 months of work in the winter, and you don't know how to translate your archaeology skills and abilities into that resume. So yeah, that's kind of where my thinking is on this episode.
No, I think that's great, because I frequently have conversations with my husband, who is not an anthropologist. He works in horticulture and golf course industry. And, you know, he kind of looks at me finishing school and bus moving and finding jobs and things like that. And, you know, he talks a lot about like, oh, I'd be interested in leaving this, but I don't have any skills that that transfer out. So I think this is not just an archaeology, anthropology problem. I think this is a universal. You're trained in undergrad in your major. And if it's super specialized, you know, he has a major in turf science.
Oh my.
Yeah. But he's a biologist, right? He was trained as a horticulturalist and a biologist.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, leads crews of people and manages complex projects and does all these other skills that are very transferable. But I think we all get locked into this is what our job is, and our skills are super specialized and don't think about those broader contexts. So I think that your take on this is an excellent one, and relevant to any of our listeners who might not be anthropologists or archaeologists, but are, you know, thinking about transitioning out of their job into our jobs, right?
It goes both ways.
It does.
You know, if you recognize these skills and abilities in yourself and you want to be an archaeologist or an anthropologist, well, like I said, it's a two-way street. So I think the only job, let's stir the pot a little bit and get some email, because we don't get enough email here. So let's get some negative email. I think the only major I can think of that literally has no transferable skills, like the only thing you can do is go teach that, and it's just an endless perpetual cycle, is philosophy.
Whoa, now. Oh, I mean, I think you could argue that maybe philosophy would make you a really good middle school teacher, because you'd be calm and zen and carefully think through the like illogical emotions of prepubescent teenagers. No.
So clearly none of my past teachers were philosophy majors, because there was nothing calm or zen about them.
So now we're going to get emails from both middle school teachers and philosophy majors. So we've played our card well.
Aren't you about to be a doctor of philosophy technically?
Oh. I'm about to send us an angry email.
That's nice. 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 We'll probably get one from your parents too. They're also doctors of philosophy. All right. So you brought up this topic. I'm going to let you kick it off with one of the things that we wrote down on our notes here. What do you want to bring up that's an anthropological skill? I think first we should describe how we use this as a skill, and then what are the things that could be used for. That's my take on it, but do whatever you want.
How do we use what as a skill? Sorry.
Like whatever we're going to talk about, you know, how do we use this thing as a skill in anthropology? And then where else could that skill be used? That's kind of what I'm thinking.
Perfect. Okay. So one of the ones that I've been thinking about a lot is what I like to call visual acuity. But I've been thinking about this. So I have, my kids are almost two. It's very exciting. They are now actually sort of humans. But one of them is, I'm pre-training as an archaeologist, and he is phenomenal at finding things. So we walk down the street and he hands me money. He's probably found like a dollar in his life so far, in pennies and nickels and dimes. And so it's made me think about the value of what I think is a really important archaeological skill, which is just the ability to see things, right? And to spot that coin lying on the ground. And it's kind of a combination of two skills. One is just paying attention to the ground and the world around you as you're moving through it, but also kind of pattern recognition, right? So if you're walking down the pavement or you're running an archaeological survey, part of what you're trying to do is find objects that don't match the pattern. So on a city sidewalk, that pattern is sort of that gray speckled sidewalk surface. And so something like a penny stands out, right? It doesn't match the background pattern.
Right.
If you're in a field or you're hiking through the desert, you're looking for, you know, rocks and plants and that kind of general desert landscape. And so you're looking for objects that don't fit. You know, they're more square, they're triangular, they're decorated or colorful. And so it's about that ability to tune out background noise and see patterns in different things in the landscape, have these kind of sharp eyes that pick mm-hmm. things up. I found it really useful both in my everyday life in acquiring small stashes of money, but, you know, it just becomes one of these skills about observing the world around you, right? I'm not sure mm-hmm. how it transfers to other jobs because clearly I have worked primarily in one, but I think it's not necessarily a job transferable skill, but it's a good life skill to have that you hone and don't necessarily think about as you're using it as an archaeologist because it's such, you know, it's just background noise to our daily lives. It's something we do. And I never thought about it till I watched a kid learning this process and saw the difference in sort of a kid who just sees these things. Oh, look, a mm-hmm. penny, a penny, a penny. And my other kid who's like, la, 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 like trotting down the street happily. He doesn't see that pattern recognition and find those objects in the same way. So I've been, that's what got me really starting to think about this and think about how we acquire these skills and how much of them are learned and how much are sort of, you have an innate skill to kind of be running that background pattern recognition.
Well, I think that's, I think that's right on point because, you know, I was just on a project down in Southern California and Arizona, which I've talked about on this, or at least on the radio show version of this. And the thing, you know, I don't go in the field very much anymore. I'm doing a lot of other background stuff. And so this was the first time in a while that I've been in the field since last year, at least. And you got historics are, I don't want to say easy to see, but historics are easy to see. I mean, come on, a tin can lying in the desert in the sand. That's kind of out of place, right? Like if you can't see that, you're probably in the wrong field. But it's that's pretty easy to see. But when you're looking at ceramics, like I haven't seen, I mean, there's no ceramics in the Great Basin, right? I mean, there's some that people are going to take me to task for that, but there's really none. I mean, there's some in like Eastern Nevada and Western Utah. You've got the Fremont traditions over there, but there's very few ceramics up here. And it's not because they weren't using ceramics, because they don't mm-hmm. preserve well in the super dry desert environment. Now, that being said, we found lots of ceramics down near Yuma and El Centro. So El Centro, California to Yuma, Arizona, we found pot drops all over the place. And I had to sort of retrain my eyes to see what I was looking for. And I think one thing that would be helpful for companies is to not just assume that people, you know, are fresh and they know what they're looking for, but to have maybe kind of a type collection and says, hey, this is what they're looking for. Because I'll tell you what, some of that sandstone looks just like a pottery sherd when you're even after a few weeks of seeing lots of ceramics, you're still picking up sandstone occasionally. But I was picking up a lot more sandstone in the beginning than I was near the end. And the same thing with lithics. And I'll tell you one thing, one way this is translated to my life outside of archaeology is in the Civil Air Patrol. In the Civil Air Patrol, I have to sit up in an airplane, either in the front right seat or the back left seat. They're two different positions. And you're basically looking out the window, and we've got search patterns that we use, and we're told what we're looking for, but we're also looking for anomalies. And when you're 1,000 feet up in the air, you know, cars and people and things like that, they're not as obvious as you'd think they would be. And you're trying to find anomalies in the background noise. And you first have to train your eyes as what does the background noise even look like? Way easier to do when there's snow on the ground, let me tell you. But when there's not, there's a lot more distractions. And, you know, we're looking at, you know, juniper and sagebrush and those kind of environments. But you would think it'd be easy to spot a, you know, a missing vehicle. It is if they're brightly colored, but a lot of times they're black or they're green or, you know, something that kind of matches the surrounding things because everything looks kind of darkish from up above. Because their shadows are typically right under it. So everything just looks dark. But trying to recognize those patterns and retrain your eyes, I feel as an archaeologist, I'm better equipped to do that. And I'm better equipped to stare out the airplane for hours at a time. Whereas other people, they get eye strain and they have to look up. And then the plane's still moving at 100 miles per hour. So when you look up, you just missed, I don't know how much ground. And you've got to, you know, anytime you pick up and rub your eyes. But in archaeology, I mean, we spend 8 hours a day just looking at the ground and probably running into stuff. I mean, people make fun of people on their phone walking into light poles on the street when they're on social media. But archaeologists have been walking into trees and sagebrush and all that stuff for years.
I never. No.
Well, walking into rattlesnakes? Come on.
I once led an entire field school over a rattlesnake before someone noticed. Yeah.
Nice.
Everyone was fine. The rattlesnake, nice. All the people. Nice. No, I think about this too. So I did ceramic analysis for a long time. And part of being a ceramic analyst is recognizing patterns, right? So you have different decoration mm-hmm. styles, but you're also often trying to see if there's any refits. So sherds that match each other or might be from the same vessel.
Yeah.
And I might've spent a sad, lonely childhood with puzzles and love puzzles, right? And puzzles are pattern recognition. So it's figuring out that the pattern on this piece matches the pattern on this other piece, right? Both the shape, but mm-hmm. also the decoration. And ceramics is really similar. You have a decoration or surface treatment, you have a shape, and you're looking for similar shapes that match each other. And it's a giant jigsaw puzzle. And how useful those skills of just saying, hey, this object goes with this object, or these two lines or two concepts match up. And I think that's a skill that does translate very effectively out of archaeology into a lot of other fields where you are, you know, you're always looking for patterns in data, patterns in behaviors, even putting together like a clothing wardrobe, right? You're looking for certain types of pattern or color matches or coordinations. And
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a skill that a lot of businesses could have. And it's really just one thing visual acuity and pattern recognition does for you is it increases your brain's ability to just pay attention.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? To just observe. And I think literally every single job could benefit from that. I can't think of a single one where if you're not paying attention to what you're doing and then noticing these other little things, I think I want to say that being an archaeologist has enhanced that skill in me. I always kind of had that ability a little bit, but it's enhanced it in other ways too. Much to my wife's chagrin, I'm always looking at something and telling her how she can do it better. And it's not because I'm, but it's not just her. Like I do that with everything, mm-hmm. you know, every time I'm in somewhere or I'm seeing a process or somebody's showing me something, I'm like, okay, well, I can see where this is good and I can see where it can be improved. And I think being an archaeologist has helped me do that just from, like I said, a paying attention standpoint, which is enhanced by your visual acuity and your pattern recognition skills. So I think, yeah, that's a big one. It's probably, God, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm glad you brought it up. It's probably one of our biggest transferable skills because it's applicable to so many areas of your life.
How do you put it on a resume?
I think you tailor it to the job that you're looking for. So if you're looking for a job as a, I don't know, a car wash attendant, I mean, let's just take the bottom of the barrel here. You're looking for a job as a car wash attendant, able to spot bugs on a car and satisfy the customer, able to, you know, recognize instead of just hand wiping down the car. Do you know how many times I've gotten a car wash and they've missed big, obvious things because they're just going through the motions and not actually paying attention? And I, you know, you pay $25 for a nice car wash and then they expect a tip. So you're $30 out and they miss stuff. You get home and you're like, oh my God, there's this huge dirt swipe on the side of my door. How did that guy miss that? You know? So I think just highlighting those things, even though they might sound superfluous, other people are not going to put that stuff on their resume. They're just not. Like, they're not going to think about it. So if you're thinking about that as an archaeologist or an anthropologist and you put that down, it might be one of those things that's not like a huge deal that they're looking for. But one thing that helps you get a job in any circumstance is standing out. If you stand out in a good way, that's great. You're going to stand out from the crowd because if they got 100 resumes for this job. But if you stand out, you can also stand out in a bad way, which means typos and, you know, bad form and things like that. So anybody that sits in the middle is unlikely to get the job. But if you stand out in a bad way, you're definitely not going to get the job. And if you stand in a good way, well, now you just move yourself to the top of the stack. So I think that's a good place to take our first break. And we will be back in just a minute to keep talking about this and bring up some more skills and abilities. Back in a second. Hey everyone, Chris Webster here with the Archaeology Podcast Network. And if you like what you're hearing, considering becoming a member and supporting us, go over to archpodnet.com/members and support us at the supporting member level, standard member, or professional member. You can do $5, $10, or $20 a month, and you can do those yearly at $42, $84, or $168 per year. Again, that's archpodnet.com/members for more information. Get early downloads, show stickers, and a whole bunch of other swag. Chris Webster here. The Archaeology Podcast Network has partnered with T Public and T Mill, but head on over to archpodnet.com/shop. You'll see all the links off to the left, including our T Mill store. For those of you in the UK and the EU, it's just easier to do shipping from that store. And if we know people are buying stuff over there, we'll add more designs. But for the meantime, we have a lot more stuff over at our T Public store, from cell phone cases for all cell phones to shirts, sweatshirts, baby clothes. I mean, it doesn't matter. Whatever you want, it's over there. And we get a little kickback from them when you buy something with our designs on it. So head on over to archpodnet.com/shop. All right, welcome back to the Archaeology Show. And we're talking about transferable skills in archaeology and anthropology. And April, you kicked off the last segment with visual acuity and pattern recognition. And I want to bring up one that I think is a great skill in my life. And I think that being an archaeologist and anthropologist has actually enhanced this. And it's basically, I wrote down note taking, but I think it's really the power to describe, because that's what I try to enhance in people. I'll bring up again this project I went on at the end of March, early April. And I'm not familiar with the ceramics in that area. I mean, let's just be honest. I'm not familiar. I've never worked there. I've worked there before, but it was in a different sort of segment. We didn't find much ceramics, but we were finding a lot of ceramics down there. And the field director, her thesis on when her master's was on ceramics in that area. So she's well versed in the different types you can find in that area and what they're called and how to describe them. Ceramics have never been my strong point. Like, they've never been my strong point. I don't typically know. Like, I know what all the stuff is called to describe ceramics, but I don't typically know, you know, much beyond that. It's just never been my strong point. But I'll tell you what, I can describe it and I can give it to a ceramicist and they can accurately type that and tell what it is, because I know how to describe the ceramics. I know how to describe the temper. I know how to describe the finish, the decoration, the piece I'm looking at. Is it a body? Is it a rim shirt? Is it a base? You know, something like that. I know how to describe all those sorts of things. And I think the power of description, that's one thing that I try to really emphasize when I've got a crew working for me or I'm talking to somebody newer in the field. I'm like, listen, I don't care if you know what that projectile point is. I'm more concerned that you know how to describe that projectile point. Do you know what the projectile point morphology is? Do you know what an ear is? Do you know what a tang is? Do you know what the margin is, the tip, the base? Do you know how to describe those things? I don't care if you know it's an Elko eared or a Clovis point or a whatever. I mean, if you do, go ahead and put that down. But if you're wrong, you're biasing the people that come along later on that think they also maybe know what it is. Or maybe they don't know what it is, and they're just going to assume, oh, they found this. And then when you type it, you know, you're locking it in its place in history. But I'm more inclined to the power of description. And I think as archaeologists, we have a huge power of description because, you know, from my own experiences, I've seen lots of stuff that I've never seen before. And I've had to describe it, especially like mining features and things like that. I mean, I don't know what the hell this base or this thing was for, but I can describe it to within a millimeter and say, hey, we've got all these things. Here are their attributes. Now, you've worked down on that, you know, an Amache. And as we've talked about before, there's got to be lots of stuff you saw maybe for the first time when you were first working out there and you didn't even know what it was, but you're able to describe it, right?
Oh, there's still things we don't know what they are.
Yeah.
You know, random twisty wire thingamajiggy, right? Which is exactly the descriptive skills that you are describing right here. No, but it is. Because we work with students, right? We work with a lot of students and volunteers. Yeah. And the hardest thing to teach them is how and when to be descriptive. So for certain things, you can write aqua Coke bottle base. And there's a style of, I know, I can see it. I can close my eyes and those words give me a complete picture of that artifact, right? But then there's other things where I need a description that says, notched triangular piece, about 18 inches by 10, bolt attaching thin metal strip at right angle, you know.
Yeah.
I need that kind of description. And when and how and the depth of detail, I think, is really, it's hard to convey. And then with this, you know, one of the skills as an archaeologist that feeds into this directly is learning, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're an archaeologist, especially if you do CRM, you're switching regions all the time. And you're not just doing historical archaeology, or you're not just doing ceramics or lithics or whatever your interest and specialty is. you're being dropped into a new state and they're saying, yeah, okay, find things. Tell us what those things are. And so you have to have this ability to rapidly absorb information.
Right.
And that, having worked with a lot of people, that's a really hard skill for some people.
Yeah. Well, that's why I always default to just the power of description, yeah, and describing and not typing and not using too much jargon and things like that. Because, you know, in CRM anyway, when we're writing up a site record, like for example, I've looked at older site records and there's a lot of jargony things in the site record that they just assume, you know, what they're talking about. And maybe the name for that thing has changed over the years. Maybe the, you know, some new research came out and now it's been lumped in with this other thing or something like that. And if you're naming it, you're giving it a set of attributes. That name comes with a series of attributes, and you're taking the easy way out by saying, yes, I mean, like, you can describe a Coke bottle as either a Coke bottle, or you can describe it as, you know, a faceted, you know, curved automatic bottle machine, aqua bottle with lithography and a base that looks like this and a crown top, you know, lip or something like that. And that describes the bottle. But if I just say Coke bottle, am I talking about a Coke bottle from 2005? Am I talking about a Coke bottle from 1935? Do they go back that far? I don't remember. Anyway, yeah, they do. They go back to like the early 1900s. Anyway, you know, what am I describing that as? And now if you're on the same project and maybe you've got some date and descriptive information in context somewhere else, then you can say, hey, this whole project dates from, you know, 1935 to 1955. So everything we're talking about is probably within that range. And then you can go back and take out your description a little more. But one thing we have in the podcasting world, from a podcasting training standpoint, a concept we have is called the curse of knowledge. And what that means is, you know, you always, any good podcaster will always try to describe and I guess elaborate on what they're talking about. Like, you and I wouldn't start this with a joke about us being at the SAAs, which is the Society for American Archaeology meetings, a couple of weeks ago, because no one else listening to this podcast knows what the heck we're talking about, right? Like, we have to assume that somebody's listening to this in 4 years, completely out of context, and this is the first episode they've ever heard. So I'm not going to say, April, how was your time at the SAAs? You know, because we're going to start by saying, oh, you and I were both at this conference for archaeologists, and this is what it is, and this is how, and then we're going to start from there. But when you start with the curse of knowledge, and a lot of archaeologists do that, they just assume people come in with this typographical knowledge of different things or regional knowledge of different things, and then they don't explain any of it. And then they write down on their site records using all these jargony terms, and then somebody coming along later on that's maybe doing some new research, maybe they're a grad student, they pull together a bunch of stuff and they're not really familiar with it yet, they're going to see all this stuff. Now, somebody might argue that they have to learn that anyway, and they will, but if we want to make our stuff more relatable, then we'll get better at description. So, and I think archaeologists, you know, that's one thing that naturally happens if you stay in this long enough, is you do get better at description. You know, you get better at describing things, partly because you learn what things are called, you learn the names of things, and that therein lies a problem too. You might be describing a car part using jargony terms for car parts.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, like describing an engine and saying pistons and valves, and somebody might not know what pistons and valves are. So, you know, I guess you're right. Like you said, you've got to decide what level of description to give it. But I don't know. I think this is definitely translatable to other things as well, that power.
Yeah, no, I think that power of descriptive ability, and it feeds right into the just ability to write that you develop as an archaeologist, where... Yeah. One of our jobs is writing, you know, when we're in the field, if hopefully we're taking field notes, we're filling out field forms. So we're writing all the time. When we're done in the field, we're coming back, we're writing up reports. If you're in academia, you're publishing all the time and writing papers and, you know, hopefully also writing for the public. And so one of the skills that we develop is just being strong and fairly versatile writers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's obviously a transferable skill. I've never met a job where they were like, oh, we don't want you to be able to write efficiently or coherently.
Right.
I mean, even sending a good, cogent email can be hard, right? thinking through what is the level of detail information that I need to tell this person? How do I tell it in the terms that they need to, that they will understand? And what, you know, how do I break it down so it's comprehensible?
Yeah. And that is where the transferable nature of this comes in, I think, is in correspondence. And because all of us, I don't care what job you're in, or maybe it's just your, I don't know, your family or social life, but what we all tend to either under or overshare on, on emails and things like that. Like I get emails all the time into my Civil Air Patrol account because my name is listed as the primary contact on our website. So when somebody wants new information, they fill out this quick form. And I say on one of the fields, I say, give me a detailed description of what you're looking for. And you know, like I got this one the other day that was just like interested in membership. Okay. What do you know? What do you, you know, what are you interested in membership? Why are you interested in the Civil Air Patrol? You know, I have to pull all this information out of people, but then other people will give me their whole entire life story. And I give them the same response I give everyone else. All right, show up to a meeting so we can talk to you. And yeah, that's basically it. I mean, they just spent 45 minutes typing out this monograph on how they were in the Air Force, and then they went into a career in this, and then they did this, and then they did this. You know, they've got 16 and a half children, and they love long walks on the beach, and they're in Aries. And I'm like, I don't care. Just, you know, give me the basics and then come on in. So understanding where that fine line is important.
You've clearly never gone to the grocery store with me. I don't know
where that's going.
Oh, I end up in these conversations with everyone at the grocery store. It takes me like an extra half an hour to get in and out because by the time I leave, I know half the residents of that grocery store's life story. So
it's, nice.
It can be problematic, I'll be honest.
And there's a skill we can just move right into as well, listening skills, because I think archaeologists are naturally inquisitive, or we wouldn't be in this job, right? Archaeologists and anthropologists, we want to know how things work and how things came to be and how people use them and you know what they learn from them and how they pass that stuff onto their families and descendants. And that's that listening ability, the ability to just shut up and take in somebody's story and really absorb it and then apply that to what you're doing out in the field. That's especially true for you. I mean, you've got actual people that were either at Amache as an internment camp, or they were at, or they have, you know, direct relationship to people that were there, you know, cause they were starting to probably lose a lot of the people that were older there because it was back in the '40s. But yeah, I mean, you get to listen to them about their experiences there and then directly translate that to what you're seeing on the ground. That's gotta be a unique experience for an archaeologist.
Yeah. I mean, it is. And being able to quietly listen to their stories, but also connect with people, like connect with them. So they want to tell you their story, I think is really important. And I mean, that's actually another amazing skill that I think especially contract archaeologists develop and have, which is the ability to be personable and be part of a team, right? We've all worked with people in the field where we did not want to work with them, right? They had that personality that they made you crawl out of your skin. They drove you crazy. And so developing the ability to connect with people readily, so people want to talk to you, they want to engage with you, they want to work with you, is important as an archaeologist because we're often in isolated situations. We're with the same people, spending lots of time with them. And that's something that every job, every employer is looking for, because you want to bring in employees that you as an employer want to work with, who are going to blend in and work really well with your team. And so I think being able to say things like, I worked closely with a small team and, you know, maintained interpersonal happiness, or having that kind of language and ability that's great. Employers want that.
Yeah, especially if you're looking for, I would even say upper management type stuff, or at least middle management type stuff. If you've got any people under you, I mean, you need to be able to get the job done because you're a manager, but you also have to be able to listen and observe your people and make sure they're happy and content and make sure you're hearing their concerns and things like that. And you're not just moving right past them. I think that's a very, a very transferable skill. I know, like you mentioned, cultural resource management archaeologists, CRM arcs, they have to, you know, we have to, I don't say have to, but we get to interact with Native Americans a lot.
Yep.
And I mean, down on that project I was on, we had two or three different Native American monitors each day, not different each day, but sometimes they did rotate out that quickly because we were working on a linear project. So we were always in someone else's territory and they're all overlapping slightly. So, you know, one day we might have these three and then one leaves and we get another one the next day, but the two are the same. So we're always talking to them, and Native Americans, rightly so, are always, they kind of start from a standpoint of mistrust a little bit of the archaeologists that are coming in because, well, they don't know us. They're used to being taken advantage of, to be honest. And we have to immediately try to earn that trust, you know, so they can work with us. And then I like to always talk to them and because they have the best knowledge of the landscape in the area. You know, what are some of these cultural features that we're looking for, or artifacts that I might not be aware of that you guys have been taught your whole lives? You know, what are these things that are just second nature to you that'll help me find these things and then help further tell that story? And they're not just going to be free with that information. They're not just going to tell you that. You know, you have to build that trust and earn it, and not earn it in a fake way, but earn it in a real way. And that's something that I've noticed in the quote real world outside of science and archaeology, it is a really hard skill for people to get, is gaining trust. You know, gaining trust is a really hard thing, and a lot of times you just have to listen and be attentive and don't be fake about it, and then you can, you know, build that trust. And don't try to build it in an artificial way, but build a real, you know, a real rapport with somebody. I don't know, it's a big skill.
Yeah, it's a hard one to develop too.
Yeah,
especially in environments where you often might be slightly transitory, right? You know, you're only interacting with someone for a day. Is it worth investing time and energy? And so being able to assess the value and benefit of those interpersonal connections.
Yeah.
I think is, you know, it's really useful. It's important.
I mean, even on that project I was on, I went down there with the understanding, and this is a whole other conversation, but I went there with the understanding that I was actually just going to be a tech, and I was doing tech support for WildNote. And on day one in the morning, I found out I was a crew chief because, you know, they needed a crew. They didn't have somebody else for it, apparently. So, and I didn't know any of the people on that crew except for one, Richie, who's actually been on this show before. I got him on that crew. So, but he actually wasn't even on my crew for a lot of it. So, so I didn't know anybody down there. And as a crew chief, I had to, and this is, I was there for 2.5 weeks. And in the first week, I was actually only there for 3 days. And then the morning part of another one, and I had to fly to San Francisco because I had a prearranged engagement. And so actually my wife and I saw Hamilton in San Francisco. And if you haven't seen it, it's amazing. But anyway, so I had just like 3 days to really kind of start building this trust in this, and not only just trust, but credibility. But with credibility comes trust, I think. And, you know, I'm coming down from Nevada and they're like probably thinking to themselves, what does this guy know? Why is he my crew chief? You know, how does he know how to do anything? But then I quickly showed my logistical abilities and my knowledge of the field and things like that, my transferable skills from Nevada down to Southern California, and how I could do that stuff. And I think I like to think that by the, you know, middle of the project, if not, you know, definitely by the end, I had gained that trust in my skills and abilities. And I think that's important for a leader to be able to do, because if they don't trust you, you know, you're the one making the call out there, the ultimate call. And if they don't trust you and you don't trust them on the backside of that, then it's all going to go badly. It's all going to fail. So, and we definitely had that on that project. There were some people that hadn't really gained that trust and they were actually losing a lot more of it. And it didn't go well for them. So it's an important skill, not just in archaeology, but in any field where you're moving into, especially a leadership role, but also in a follower role. You know, that's what we call it in the military, is leaders and followers. And it's important to learn how to be a good follower as well as a good leader. And it's not a lot of people are good followers. they either don't like being in that role, or they don't know how to do it in a way that's respectful and a part of a team and getting the job done. So those are definitely skills you have to learn as an archaeologist, whether or not you know you're calling it that stuff. We're all doing it, and we're all either part of a crew or on a crew and or leading a crew. We're all one of those things, and you're never just a single person out in the field. You've always got somebody you're either answering to or people that are answering to you. And learning how to manage that is a pretty big skill. Okay, well, I think that's a good break point for this segment. We'll come back in and wrap this up with a few other things. You know, we only had like 8 things on this list, and I was like, man, we're going to need to come up with some more, but I think we've only gone over like 3 of them.
Yeah, I know. It's each time we say something, we realize the other like embedded skills that are part of this skill.
Yeah.
So it's good.
Yeah, it all connects. All right, back in a minute. Hey, everybody. If you're listening to this podcast, you're interested in education, you're interested in archaeology, and we got something that combines both. Head on over to patreon.com/Team Black, and you'll see the Team Black Patreon page. We have lots of areas and ways that you can support us, anywhere from $1 a month at a team supporter, all the way up to $25 a month at Team Black Master. At each one of these tiers, you get videos that were produced by Team Black, videos that were produced by other experts in the field. We've got everything from rock art to getting a job in cultural resource management to field tech basics to, you know, COSO rock art. I mean, all kinds of different things. And check it all out. We're always adding new videos. And you can join for 1 month, watch everything, and then cancel if you want. But we're looking for people who want to support us. They want this education. They want to watch these videos on their own time and learn something in the process. So patreon.com/Team Black. That's patreon.com/Team Black. Chris Webster here from the Archaeology Podcast Network to talk about Timular, one of our affiliates. Head over to archpodnet.com/Timular. Click through there and you'll see this 8-sided cube that I use for tracking all my time as a project manager, all my time between the Archaeology Podcast Network and everything else I do. All you do is label the sides and then you flip it for each thing that you do, and it tracks your time exactly. You're able to export that as an Excel spreadsheet or CSV file to add to your timesheet. So if you're doing project tracking or any sort of tracking, then use Timular. If you're out in the field, you can actually use it on just your mobile device as well. So get Timular at archpodnet.com/Timular. Help support them and support archaeological education and outreach.
Well, welcome back to the Archaeology Show, everyone. We are talking about archaeology skills and how they translate into real life. And when we left off our last segment, we were just talking about leadership. And I have realized, having been a leader, but also having been a follower for, a while, is one of the things that makes a good leader is a leader that you know will do everything. So there, I've had leaders that don't model the behaviors that they want to see. Right? Mm-hmm. So the leader who sits on the bucket and tells you how to dig versus the leader who stands up, shows you how to dig, and then digs next to you, but stops when they need to do something like a leadership style paperwork, right? Because when you're in a leadership role, you do have slightly different responsibilities. But I think really good leadership that you develop as a, you know, as a contract archaeologist and hopefully as an archaeologist in general is that kind of hard work ethic of not asking your followers to do something that you yourself are unwilling to do.
That is such a good specific example for me, too. It reminds me back to actually one of the first excavations I did here in the Great Basin. And it was right when I got out of grad school. I was put in charge. We were digging these 10 by 10 meter block units. So we, you know, there were 100 one by one units within each one of these 10 meter blocks. And I was put in charge of one of those 10 meter blocks. And you know, I had everybody digging in sort of a checkerboard pattern from one side to the other so they wouldn't be right next to each other's walls. And I opened up a unit right at the beginning on the far side because I knew that I was going to take probably the whole session to dig that unit. I mean, I was expecting people to get a unit a day done because they were only going down about 20, 30 centimeters. And I knew they could probably do that. So either unit a day or even 2 units a day in some cases if they were shallower. But I knew that I was going to take the whole session because that's the one thing that really irritates me, and you see this on projects a lot, is somebody gets into that position where they're the leader of the thing, right? Especially like an excavation. If you're on survey, you have to walk. I mean, there's no way. If you're the field director, you might be in a truck somewhere and you're doing access and things like that. But even then, there's definitely some days you can get and walk with the crew because it's not every single day you've got paperwork. If every single day you've got paperwork and you've got things to do, then you're either running a crew of 100 people or you're just not very good at your job. I mean, I have to say that. So if you're either not efficient or you're running a crew of 1,000 people or 100 people and you've got a ton of stuff to do. But in that case, you probably need more people under you to help take care of that paperwork. But either way, if you're constantly doing that, I feel like you're doing something wrong. So the reality is you've always got a little bit of time that you can spend. So I would spend all this time. I was taking a lot of notes. I was making sure I knew when somebody came to me, I already knew what unit they were going to move to. And I could process their artifacts, take in their bags, put them in the catalog. We did all this in the field and then, you know, move them on to the next thing. But that wasn't an 8-hour job. You know, that was a few minutes each time somebody came to me. And sometimes I had to go do some other stuff. But, you know, probably half of my day, I was able to get into my unit and just start digging. So I was just working on the other side of the block. So I didn't get in their way and work in my unit. And I think that, again, I was a lot slower because I got interrupted a lot. But I think that's what's important, like you just said, for people to be able to demonstrate those skills, but also know where that fine line is. You know, some people also do the opposite thing where they just kind of avoid all their paperwork and then they work with the crew. Then they're screwed at the end. And that's also bad leadership.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bad time management, I should say.
Yeah, no. And I think some of this comes down to, as a leader, you know, obviously leadership and crew management and project management skills, you know, those are just sort of the core, the activities that you were doing. The type of paperwork, the type of recording, the specifics may not be transferable, right? Because the mm-hmm. specifics of any job really are. But the basic ability, so, you know, the ability to delegate well, to figure out which of your crew members or team members are, what are their strengths, right? So mm-hmm. being able to say, this person is really good at writing and really good at meticulous and careful paperwork, I can give them a little bit of extra responsibility. Because they're yeah. very good at this. Meanwhile, this person has an artistic flair and they can hop around and help draw some of these walls and profiles. And so assessing skills, delegating, and just trusting your crew, you know, these are all mm-hmm. really good, easily transferable skills that I think we're just bad about verbalizing, right? They're so innate. Yeah. We don't even think about them as we're doing them. It's when you stop and you decide that you're going to record a podcast talking about these kinds of things that you actually think through, what are they? Like, what are these skills? How do I use them? How do I employ them in other situations and settings? Am I really doing them?
Yeah.
And you have that sort of self-reflexive moment.
Well, and that actually is another skill, I think, that you can learn from running projects, because we all kind of do this a little bit, and some companies are better about it than others. But again, something I get from the military and the Civil Air Patrol is what's called an after-action report. And usually we do what we call in Civil Air Patrol, we call it a hot wash. I mean, right when the event is done. So we do search and rescue exercises once a month, and say it runs from 7 a.m. until 2 or 3 p.m. on a Saturday. At the end of that event, when all the teams have returned and we've got the place cleaned up, people are ready to go home, we sit down for probably at least 15 minutes to 45 minutes, and we go over immediately, while it's fresh in your head, what went right and what went wrong. And then each of the different departments, they fill out their own section of this, and then whoever's in charge of the event fills out what's called an after-action report over, you know, what did we do, what can we learn from, what did we do better? What did we do worse? Blah, 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 blah. What are we going to do next time? And we send that off to the director for the Nevada wing. And then they get that from each squadron that did a SARX, we call it, a search and rescue exercise. So companies, and I think individual project managers, they probably do that on somewhat of a more unofficial capacity. They look back and they say, wow, I'm never going to do that again. Or, yeah. You know, maybe that went really well or something like that. And I'm going to use that next time. But I think one thing we can learn, again, transferring these skills back into archaeology and then transferring them back out, is how to really sit down and do a very specific introspection of, you know, yourself and your abilities and how that went, like you and I are doing pretty much right now for our entire careers, but doing that on a specific project to project basis. Like you guys out at Amache, to keep coming back to that, you only do that every 2 years. So you come back 2 years from now, and I'll tell you what, time erases all mistakes, right? So you just come back and you have to really be specific and say, wow, we're never going to do that again, but let's write that down so we make sure we don't do that next year.
Oh yeah, no, we definitely, at the end of every field school, we stop and we say, what went wrong? What went right? And mm-hmm. we've also realized, so as an archaeologist and someone who runs projects, right, you develop a set of protocols. This is how things are done. This is the order of steps. This is the processes. These are the paperwork. Done. You get them established. You use them again and again and again and again. And one of the things that we have slowly become aware of is that technology changes, right? So we started out and we had a total station, and you set up the total station. And so we designed a protocol based on the fact that we had a physical total station. Mm-hmm. And then we switched using handheld trimbles, right? Yeah. And now we switched to using iPads, in which each of those switches, we haven't necessarily, it takes a moment to be like, oh, wait, we have to change the protocols, right?
Yeah.
The paperwork might still basically work, but the steps, the orders in which you do things need to change, the logic behind things changes a little bit, and stop and say, okay, let's re-examine the processes that we're using and making sure that they're still lining up and they're still the most efficient and still the most effective. And in some ways, having things like field projects or a field school where it's terminal, right?
Yeah.
It ends and you can stop. Meanwhile, you know, if you run a contract company, you're sort of always going. You have each project, but, you know, there's not this sort of, well, our 5 weeks are over. Let's do an assessment.
Right.
Write it down, pack it up for the next year and a half, pull it out, blow it off, and set out. So, yeah. No, we definitely are really careful about that but it took us, it actually took us a couple of years to think through this, realize it. And it took one of our crew chiefs who had done a lot of contract work to kind of say, why are you still doing it this way? Let's change it. And then Bonnie and I had this epiphany moment of, oh my gosh, we've always done it this way, but our technology has changed and we haven't.
Yeah.
And we need to now stop and change. And, you know, that goes back to listening, right? Listening and trusting crew members and members of the whole team and recognizing that they have different experiences and they're going to bring those to your crew. And that can have a lot of value.
And that right there is another very good transferable skill that I think is almost unique to archaeologists, because every time we go out, we're almost always working with somebody new, whether we're training up students or in CRM where you've got a new crew every single time and people are moving around job to job. I mean, even if you're running a field school or something like that, it's literally new people every single time with a few exceptions. And you have to be able to do two things. As a leader, you have to be able to assess the skills and abilities of the people under you, even if they're brand new. You could get somebody at your field school that decided to go to college at the age of 40, and now they're in this thing. And before that, they were, you know, a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force doing logistics. You know, that person might not know much about archaeology, but I'll tell you what, they could organize the crap out of your project, right? If they just understand the component parts, they would be a great person to say, okay, you organize the vehicles, the equipment, the hotel rooms, all that stuff, because that is your skill set, buddy. You manage that. Or you might get somebody who's, who is a mom, an early mom. Like my mom had me when she was 16, had my brother when she was 18. And I'm not saying she has these abilities, but somebody in a similar circumstance might be, kids are out of the house and they're in their late 30s, and then they go back and get an anthropology degree, and now they're on your field school. Well, understanding those skills of somebody who just raised a few children, I'll tell you what, they're better capable of probably dealing with younger people than I would be. I'm 44 and have no kids. So, you know, it's not a skill I possess. and I would have to rely on that person that has dealt with, you know, younger people a lot, that can maybe do that. I don't know. It's just recognizing those skills and abilities is something we need to do in archaeology, but it's also something you need to do in literally every other job that you're in, because you're always getting new people in, you know, unless you work for GM or something where everybody works there for 40 years, there's always going to be, you know, new people coming in, and recognizing that they're not just new in this, they're new in this job, but they're not new in life, and finding out, you know, what really are they good at and putting them in those places. Yeah, I don't know. It's got to be a special at, you know, you running field schools. I've never actually run a field school, so I don't have that experience. And I've been on a field school, of course, but I've never run one. And I don't know. You go into teacher mode probably every single year that you do it, and it's always different depending on the people that you have.
Oh yeah, no, and I think being an archaeologist, you become very adaptable and flexible to new circumstances and new people and new situations. I mean, one of the themes we've talked about elsewhere in this podcast, and I know in the other podcasts on the podcast network, are just, you know, some of the field skills and how much we move around and the different interesting food and living situations and bathroom situations and personnel situations that we all end up in, right? And that level of flexibility, I think ability to sort of improvise, professional improvisation, right? Like, I have forgotten this, and as such, I shall tape two things together and glue a third one on, and lo and behold, you know, so we learn to just sort of be, you know, be flexible and improvise in a setting where we don't necessarily have all the tools and abilities to access things that we normally do. And that's another really good, again, I'm periodically, I think about how you word these on your resume, right? Give me a stick of gum and I'll MacGyver it.
That's right. If you can't do it with duct tape. So, yeah, one of the mottos of the Civil Air Patrol, I keep coming back to that because it's a major influence on my leadership and other things like that. But one of the mottos is Semper Vigilance, which is always always vigilant, right? Always watchful and things like that. But the unofficial motto is Semper Gumby, which is basically always flexible. Gumby is not Latin, of course. I don't know if anybody knows what Gumby means. It's an older reference, but yeah, Semper Gumby. So look that up. But anyway, you're right. The ability to be constantly flexible. We had a guy on our crew that last project I was on that was really dealing hard with some administrative issues with the company and some other stuff he was dealing with. And he was very inflexible. And I'll tell you what, he had a pretty bad time on that project. Like he was always nervous. He was always worried about stuff. And not only that, you know, not to add to his pain, but he actually saw his first rattlesnake ever in the field on his third to the last day ever as an archaeologist, because he was actually getting out to go do another job. Like he got this certificate. This is his last archaeology project ever, he hoped. And he'd never seen a rattlesnake in the field. And on like 3 days before the end, he saw his first one as he's dealing with some of these administrative issues. And it just totally threw him off his game. And then an hour later, he saw his second one.
Oh, no.
It was so bad. Like none of us had one. I actually saw one on my line, but I avoided it. And I didn't make a big scene about it because it didn't, you know, strike me. I saw it like, you know, 20 feet away and I went around it. But he didn't have a good day and he didn't have a good rest of the week either. But that's just attitude. You know what I mean? So, yeah. All right. Well, we only have about a minute and a half left on this. So, do we want to tackle some of these last ones? I mean, I think project management I've got on here, it translates into a lot of the other things we've mentioned. You know, project management really just is the ability to assess what you have and understand the timeline and keep within that time frame using the assets you've been given. And assets are, of course, vehicles and instruments and things like that, but also people and understanding what those people can do and using as the most effective way they can. And I firmly believe if you grasp and you really get project management as an archaeologist, man, there are so many jobs out there that are just looking for project managers. And you might think, well, I don't know how to manage a project in a glass factory doing this, or in a, you know, car manufacturing facility or some other factory or something like that. I don't know how to do that. But you really don't have to know how to do that. You have to know how to lead and assess what you're given and understand a timeline. And I think if you can learn that at any job, then you'd be a great project manager. I really firmly believe that. I don't know. That's just my two cents on project management. Anything else, April?
No, I mean, I think the end result of this is that there's endless skills that we don't necessarily think of as skills. And the challenge then becomes how on your CV or your resume do you put these in terms that are not, you know, we've talked about a lot of the terms, right? We've broken down the archaeological things that we do into skills, but, you know, then it becomes the act of actually writing them down in a way that, you know, employers don't just see this list of I'm smart and pretty, but actually see, hey, I run big crews. I understand interpersonal communication, delegation, blah, 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 and hit those key terms. So I think that's always the hardest part. is actually Indeed. Translating them into the terms that people from other fields look at. I know that's, you know, been one of the dialogue about people who, you know, as veterans get out of the military, they have intense and amazing skills that they've learned, but figuring out how to put them onto a civilian CV, right?
Yeah.
And it's the same thing as you leave archaeology. How do we take those skills and put them onto a CV for another career field?
Well, one thing that's an advantage to veterans is you actually take, when I took it, it was about a week long. I don't know how long it is now, but there was a week long course I took where you show up in civilian clothes. The only military thing you ever showed up for in civilian clothes, because they want to get you in that mindset. But it taught you how, it was a class on teaching you how to be a civilian. Not only understanding your veterans benefits, but how to find jobs. Because a lot of people went in right out of high school.
Yeah.
And they have no idea. You know, I was only, you know, almost 23 when I got out. So I didn't have, you know, a lot of military experience or even life experience. But other guys that were in my class, I mean, they were retiring from 20, 25 years in the military, and they went in right out of high school, and they have no idea how to be a civilian, like no idea. And because they've never been a civilian adult. And that's a weird concept, but it's a very different lifestyle. So we don't have that in archaeology, which is something I'm trying to fix with my, you know, webinar on getting out of archaeology. So I'll just leave you guys at this. Check out patreon.com/teamblack and check out that webinar. It's at one of the lowest levels. So I think for $3 a month, you can actually see that webinar. And it's pretty good. I got to say, I've had other people take that course when I was offering it as a webinar, and they got a lot of good stuff out of it. So sometimes it's just about working through the things we have. And like you said, April, figuring out how to write it down. So, all right. Well, thanks a lot, April, for being on the show.
Hey, I'm happy to be back.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, we'll be back next time with another great show. And again, if you're listening to this on KMVC, welcome. If you're not, I do a live radio show of this podcast on Fridays from noon to 1 Pacific time on knvc.org/listen-live. So check that out, and feel free to call in. I give out the phone number and the email address and things like that, and you can call in and be on the radio and talk to me about archaeology. All right. We'll be back next week. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.